find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Kaleidoscience, Conversations on Cognitive Science. This episode is hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sophie Kühner.
Today we're going to talk about one topic where I feel like it's getting more and more popular over the past maybe 10 years, where I didn't have any, or where I didn't get into touch until I started studying at university, because I have a friend who's self-considering her as an individual of, well, a transgender individual. And today we're going to talk to Jen Eikes, who is currently an assistant professor at the Osnabrück University and is researching in the area of transgender and philosophy and the intersection, besides other topics they are interested in. Previously, they were a deputy professor for philosophy in Bayreuth and did their PhD at the School of Mind and Brain at the Humboldt University in Berlin. Welcome. We're happy to have you as a guest today.
Hi. Thanks for the invitation.
Hello. Welcome. We are going to play a little beloved get-to-know game. So I'm going to read you the beginning of 5 sentences, and I would like to ask you to complete the sentences just briefly. Don't overthink it. As a kid, I always wanted to be
a farmer.
Fun. If I was an emoji, I would be
the neutral emoji.
What's neutral?
With the straight mouth, maybe.
Okay. To me, it doesn't feel neutral, but okay. My favorite thing to do on a day off is
Take photos.
Nice. I know it's time to call it a day when...
when it's 10 p.m., I guess.
Okay. And I just skipped a question I noticed. Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
the intersection of masculinity and emotion.
Oh, interesting.
It's very cool. Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about your scientific journey? So what did you study and how did you get where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. I studied philosophy, political science, and English in Stuttgart, actually. And I can't really tell you how I got where I am now, but I was sort of recommended by some postdocs and profs back then to do my PhD in philosophy. Then I applied to the Berlin School of Mind and Brain. They decided to take me in, and then I did my PhD at this School of Mind and Brain and Freie Universität Berlin. And I got in touch with a lot of people who work on the philosophy of emotion, which is what I'm doing now, and the philosophy of social interaction, social cognition, which is what I used to do mostly in the last couple of years. And then I just, yeah, kept doing philosophy and kept applying for jobs and worked in different jobs ever since I finished my PhD.
Nice, very cool. Okay. What is gender? Difficult question to start with, but...
That's a really big question. Gender is many different things. A lot of people, I guess, also... somewhat dated accounts have identified gender as something that consists of both gender identity and gender presentation and gender expression. That's kind of the, I would say, old school way of framing it. So gender identity, meaning you identify as either a man or a woman or non-binary or agender or something completely different. Gender expression, meaning how do you sort of carry the thing you feel inside to the outside, what kind of clothes do you wear and so on. And nowadays we have theories, for example, that try to move away from this term gender identity to sort of try and grasp better the stuff that's going on inside, or the kind of first personal relation I have or someone has to what their gender feels like. So we're moving more towards this question of what does me being a man actually feel like, or how does it feel like, and what does that mean to me personally? So, for example, there are two philosophers named Ray Briggs and B.R. George, and they have written a book on what is, I think, what even is gender is the book called. And they came up with this theory that's called, or with an account that incorporates something they call gender feels, by which they mean to address all the first personal experience that we have regarding gender. Yeah, so it's really hard to define gender. I don't think I can do that. But there is a lot of work out there that tries to define gender according to different, yeah, using different concepts and different terms to explain what it is.
Maybe it helps to differentiate it from the term of sex. Or would you not agree and say it's totally okay? No, okay.
Yeah.
Why not? Because I feel like, or at least I feel like for a person who is not deeply into the topic and self.
I know that's just not the view I okay. agree with. So
it's not could you maybe explain why you would not agree?
Oh, because I think it's an artificial definition, and sex is already always gendered. So it's really hard to say what is sex without saying what is gender, or without subscribing to a view of what gender is. Because I could say something like, I don't know, sex is, I don't know, a compilation of different characteristics that people have, but the concepts we have of these characteristics are already gendered, right? Because we use concepts to describe what's going on with the thing we call sex, but those carry meanings about what masculinity is and what femininity is. So that's why I think it's hard or impossible, I think, to sort of keep those apart.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And in the topic of gender, what is trans?
Trans, well, usually people mean by that someone doesn't identify with whatever they were assigned at birth. So both either sex or gender categories they were assigned at birth. Meaning if someone was assigned or was told you're a boy at birth, or maybe also if we think about different societies that don't have this strict legal characterization at birth that people that we have in Germany, we could also say society assigns a gender to you. So if society at whatever stage tells you you're a boy or a girl, and you disagree with that, the common understanding is that you're trans. But of course, people have different ways of conceptualizing their own transness, or different ways of also experiencing their own transness. I think most would agree that there is something they disagree with in terms of what has been assigned to them from the outside. But I think there's a lot of people who would maybe say something like, I was born in the wrong body, because that used to be the common narrative that people have of transness. And other people would say, I just am trans, or I just am a man and I happen to be trans because I was not told that I was a man when I was born. Some people identify as non-binary and thereby identify as trans. That's also then again a different conceptualization of transness, right? Some people pursue medical transition, some people don't. So there's all these different ways of understanding transness. The most basic thing I think we all agreed on sort of as the umbrella thing for transness is that there was something assigned to us that doesn't fit.
Would it be the same in a society, hypothetically, where no genders are assigned to you at birth?
As I said, I think it also happens later. Mm-hmm. That's why I said we can imagine a society where this procedure that we have in Germany doesn't take place, right? But then you still have society that assigns gender to you based on how you look, based on how you behave, based on, I don't know, what your parents call you or whoever else calls you. So I think there's all these societal ascriptions that happen that don't even have to track anything legal, right? But that still happens sort of on a daily basis. Think about going, when you go to a coffee shop and the waiter, waitress tells you, says something like, hey, young lady, would you like a coffee? Something like that, right? Sometimes people use that kind of language, and that's an ascription that happens, or that's a gender ascription that happens. So yeah, I think there is a sense in which it would still happen even if we didn't have this legal procedure at birth. But perhaps it would be different. If we didn't have this kind of ascription at all, I don't know what we would have to describe our transness, or if transness would exist, if that would be a thing. Maybe people would be free to express or to be whoever they are. But that's very hard to imagine because our society is so strictly gendered.
Since you're currently mostly in philosophy, what role does philosophy play in general in the context of trans experience and transness?
So there is trans philosophy, right? Which is like a sub area in philosophy that is concerned with trans realities, but not only concerned with trans realities, as if it's like an outside perspective that looks into the, tries to look in, into some group or into the inside, but a kind of, or trans philosophy is something that is done via trans perspective. So most of the people have some kind of first personal experience with transness, whether that's themselves or their kids or their partner, is open. And trans philosophy tries to illuminate different aspects of trans lives in a non-pathologizing way, because trans lives have been so pathologized, especially in science, especially in research, also in philosophy, right? There have been so many wrong descriptions of what trans experience is, what transness is, so many stereotype ways of displaying our realities. In trans philosophy, alongside maybe trans studies, is trying to sort of tidy up that mess and say, okay, now we're doing our own philosophy, and we're doing that kind of theory that really illuminates our realities without pathologizing our experience, without stereotyping our experience, or without just basically publishing wrong information about us. So it's a very trans affirmative also experience to do that kind of work, basically. I don't think that philosophy, that being said, I don't think that even trans philosophy really plays a role for trans experience, right? It doesn't really change anything about the experience, I think. Maybe for me personally, if I write something about it, but I don't think it changes anything for other people, because the one thing that trans philosophy also subscribes to doing, or has been challenged to do by a couple of trans philosophers recently, is to say, well, you can't just sit in your sort of academic chambers and try to come up a priori with some, I don't know, arguments about what transness is, or with some arguments about what trans realities are. But you also have to talk to your own communities. You have to go into trans spaces. You have to talk to different trans people. You have to talk to non-academic trans people, to trans people of color, to disabled trans people, and so on. You have to take all of these experiences into account in order to say anything about trans realities. So trans philosophy right now, I think, is trying to move away from that very academic only focus, because they realize they have been really, I don't know, making theories mostly for other academics, which is fair enough in itself. I guess it's a discipline, right? But they do want to also do something else. They also want to illuminate trans experience beyond the academy.
Is it mainly that people who are trans are active or are working in trans philosophy, or is it rather an outsider initiated subfield?
No, it's a completely trans initiated subfield. There are rare exceptions that I would say in the field, or that have published texts in the field that are not trans, because they're widely considered to have published trans affirmative texts or trans centered publications. But it's really the exception. So most people in the field are trans, non-binary, and inter. Yeah.
And You also did some research on how the internet, so like social media, influences the experience of LGBTQIA plus people, right?
Yeah.
Could you tell us some more about the experience of trans individuals in this and also about the research in general?
Yeah, sure. That research I've done was part of a bigger project that worked on, was like an interdisciplinary project where people try to figure out the effects of digitization very broadly on different groups or different groups in our society. And the one subgroup or subproject that I've come up with was sort of, yeah, the effects of digitization on LGBTQIA plus people. So the way I went about this was trying to combine theory with more empirical work. So I teamed up with some people who know more about empirical work than I do, although I've been trained a little bit in it, but it's still good to team up with other people who know more about this. And then we designed interviews. So we interviewed 25 people on the LGBTQIA plus spectrum. Most of them were trans and non-binary. And we interviewed them. We had sort of guiding questions that guided our interviews and that we could orient ourselves along during the interviews. But it was really up to them. We weren't out for like a specific result. It was kind of a ground up approach where the people we interviewed are the ones that sort of contribute to the theory we're going to write. I chose that approach because I thought it was important to really take into account what the experience of these people are without coming with any preconceptions that I may have from my academic background or whatever other background I have, right? And we came up with, I guess, maybe not super surprising results. The people in the interviews reflected a lot on what social media mostly means to them. So digitization was mostly sort of focused on social media and the influence of social media. Social media had on coming out as trans and coming out as queer. And they all basically said that social media was a massive help for them because some of them also grew up on the countryside or in sort of, I don't know, conservative households where they didn't really have any access to any kind of knowledge around trans issues or knowledge around queer stuff. And then their social media was a big help for them because they felt like they could access some kind of knowledge and they could see other people who identified as trans. And that sort of enabled them to also sort of see a future for themselves or see the possibility of coming out for themselves or see the possibility, for example, of identifying as non-binary, because that's a concept that some of them hadn't realized before that existed. And it was really the media and social media especially that enabled them to see that this was a possibility. They also, of course, reflected on the dangers, mostly on the dangers of sort of staying within your own group the whole time, or also on the dangers of some people that are very anti-queer or anti-trans that comment hateful stuff on other people's social media pages, for example. They also reflected on the challenge that a lot of their identity seems to take place online, but not in real life. And it has been hard for them to sort of transfer that identity to real life. So there has been a lot of different reflections from different angles. But I would say the common tenor was that social media was really helpful, but that they still sort of see the risks associated with social media and would wish for, I don't know, a better version of social media that's more regulated. Yeah.
And in what you just described, it's a lot about the information, but is it also about community? Because when you, for example, come from a little village, there might only be a limited number of people around.
Yeah.
And it's harder to find other people outside of that.
Yeah, exactly. It's first and foremost about just sort of seeing other people that are like you or that maybe are like you, right? A lot of the people that I interviewed didn't know before they had encountered, for example, a non-binary person talking about their own experiences, that they were non-binary. So it was really a help for them to, yeah, to be able to see themselves, basically. And that's, I think, that's a form of community, right? But that's also a form of knowledge. Or that's sort of a gateway to more knowledge about this identity, because you have to learn about it, because you feel, maybe you feel like, oh, that could be my identity. Now I want to learn more about it. And that enables me to identify as it or not to identify as it. And yeah, some people reflected on having found a sort of community, but there was also a big sort of gap between online and offline lives, because they did find that, sure, online there was a lot of representation, especially your first directed to influencers, right, with big accounts that you can follow, but obviously most of them don't follow you back. So it's not a reciprocal relationship in a lot of cases. That's what they reflected on. And thereby they also reflected on sort of having found a community, but it's a more distant community. They have found some kind of belonging to a specific group of people, but not really a community in the sense that these are people they can really sort of, I don't know, go to on a Friday night and connect with and talk about problems they might have. So there's different notions of community at play, and they were pretty critical of having found like a proper old school community in social media.
Yeah, makes sense.
That was just what I was partly thinking about, is that when I, whichever topic is it's about, hear how people who are not affected talk about the influence of social media, for example, may it be mental health related, may it be gender related, transgender related topics, that people who are not affected often argue, well, now everybody, well, really large parenthesis here, but now everybody has this, which of course is a really narrow view on realities. But you now talked about how it actually helped people who kind of felt before that there's no congruency between what they experience or what they feel and how they are perceived socially, and that it helped them to see other people. Did you find anything about in how far this kind of also conflict between people commenting on it affected individuals?
You mean like hateful comments?
Hateful, also those skeptical, well, you are now just all in this bubble because you now see it online.
We didn't really reflect on that in the interviews, I think. I'm not sure. It's hard to, I mean, obviously there's a trope that says social media makes people trans, which is very absurd and obviously not true. But there is a sense in which we can look at how social norms influence what kind of transness we identify with, right? Maybe for like, if you think about it, like sort of like a thinking exercise where you think, okay, these are the three images you're presented with. So you're on the one hand, maybe presented with a, let's say, very stereotypical trans man, and then a non-binary person who's very stereotypically androgynous, and then a stereotypical trans woman. I'm putting all of these in parentheses because, right, it's a stereotype. But say you're only confronted with these three images, of course that's going to have an influence on how exactly you're able to construct your own identity, especially if social media is the only place where you have any kind of connection. So it's not like we can say something like social media doesn't have any impact at all on your identity. I think it has an impact on all of our identities in one way or another, and we can ask the question, what kind of impact does it have? How does it influence the norms we embody? How does it influence our own conceptions of transness, our own conceptions of gender, or also what you mentioned, our conceptions of specific mental health categories, right? We can also ask that there. But it's kind of this trope that I mentioned, that social media makes people trans or makes people a certain way, is obviously an absurd way of putting what I just put, and a way of anti-trans narratives, basically, that just try to say, something like transness is a trend. 20 years ago, there weren't as many trans people as there are now, which is true, but it's also, it's true because people can now come out or used to be able to be out and to learn about their identities. We don't know how it's going to be like in 5 years. There's probably going to be a decline because of all the massive polarization against trans people, or movements against trans people, or trans rights, essentially, that we see globally right now. So it's probably going to be on a decline again. But yeah, there have been lots of anti-trans narratives and this transness as a trend, including a trend that happens on social media, is one of these anti-trans narratives.
Maybe this brings us quite nicely to the next question, which would be, why is it relevant to talk about the experience of trans people?
Because it's a part of human life. It's as relevant as talking about snails or frogs or, I don't know, leaves or other human beings. That's why. I think it's just a normal part of human life, right? Human experience is very different. People are very different. Some people happen to be trans and happen to be talking about their transness. So why not listen to them?
And you've also already touched on that it's not clear how life will change for trans people in the next years.
Yeah.
Could you maybe tell us a bit about how it is in general for trans people at the moment to live in this society, in this uncertainty globally?
I mean, I can just speak for myself. I don't know how it is for every trans person, but the rights situation right now is pretty severe in that, for example, there is this organization that's called Transgender Europe, TGEU for short. They're both focused on Europe and Central Asia. And they just published a report in which they refer to a transgender tipping point. So they point out that now is the moment where at which we have more of a regression of trans rights and in trans rights and sort of, trans rights mostly, than progress. So, and that's the first time this is happening in 13 years. So more countries have published or pushed for or made legally binding laws against the inclusion of trans people than pushed for the inclusion of trans people. For example, I'm not sure that's a law yet, but for example, as a recent push for a law, we have the bathroom ban for trans people in the United Kingdom, right? But we also have all these horrible laws in Hungary, for example, that don't just attack trans people, but also attack all queer people. So they go against the right to marriage. They go against name and gender marker change, for example. And then in the EU, there's also still some countries that have forced sterilization for trans people, and there has been no progress literally in the past couple of years. So in some countries, in order to make a gender marker change, to update your gender markers to have the one that fits your identity, you have to go through a sterilization process in some countries, for example, in the Czech Republic, in order to have that. If you don't do that, you can't update your gender marker. And there hasn't been any progress made on this recently. Maybe what's worse is the pushback against trans rights that has happened, especially in the past 3 years. That's now, according to TGEU, reached a tipping point.
Yeah, that's very hard to hear, obviously. I'm aware of the political situation and I'm also following it, but it's hard to hear every time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I always wonder where this like hate kind of comes from, because obviously I would say if you're a cis person and you don't know any trans people, I don't even fully understand how you can be invested to hate a group that much. This is something that has never made a lot of sense to me in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder if there's any research on where this might be coming from or how this might come about.
Yeah, there's a bunch of research that has been done in trans philosophy. There's, for example, the pretty well-known trans philosopher Talia Becher, who talks about transphobia and tries to... I'm not sure if she would say she comes up with explanations for transphobia, but she tries to... Yeah, I guess she tries to illuminate what transphobia amounts to, at least, what it means for trans people, how horrible it is for trans people, and in what ways, and also in what subtle ways it manifests. Because now, well, we've now heard of about this pushback against trans rights, but it doesn't start there, right? It doesn't start with some political government saying, hey, let's take away these rights from this group of people, which is also a tiny group of people, I should mention, right? It's not so that the randomness becomes obvious. So it's a very targeted attack on a random group of people that happens to be a pretty tiny group of people. I think that's something that people also need to realize. But so, for example, Becher points out that it's not just this pushback against rights that's transphobia, but maybe specific behaviors that people display in everyday lives that sort of have transphobia underlying, or sort of have an underlying transphobia. Or, yeah, she just points to different ways in which transphobia can manifest. There's also some research done, I don't know if anything of that is published, but Maren Berenson does research on sort of the ties between fascist governments and transphobic narratives, and that are especially pushed by anti-trans feminist networks that try to appeal to mothers, especially mother or parents of trans kids. And Maren looks at the ties between these fascist ideologies and the kind of maybe also money exchange happening between different ideological movements, one of which is the TERF movement, right? So it's not that there's all these random individuals that happen to have hateful feelings against trans people, but it's really an organized attack against a tiny group of people. And of course, not everyone's involved in organizing it, but a lot of people are mobilized through social media, through emotional instrumentalization on social media, and so on.
Is there any starting point you can recommend for anyone who is not, or who has never had contact with trans realities, to start educating themselves? So especially cis people who have no friends who are trans, or just have no idea about realities.
I think their starting point should be themselves. So first of all, look inwards, take a deep breath, get rid of all your biases, and then maybe try to look at some sort of outreach things that people have, that trans people especially have done. Maybe don't look at the general media and all the portrayals of trans people in the general media, because they're usually very, I would say, a bit off, maybe, because they're always pushed through the journalist's narrative or through the newspaper's narrative, whatever. I would say try to look at outlets that trans people themselves have created, whether that's in English or German or whatever other language. I think that's a good starting point. There's also, I mean, it depends on what kind of media someone prefers, right? There's podcasts, there's books that people can read that are also all sort of done in accessible ways, so you don't have to read theory to understand what transness is or what trans realities amount to. But there's plenty, I think, I don't know, popular media outlets that people can rely on now.
Nice. Okay, we have one last question to tie this all together. So we are a cognitive science podcast. So we kind of always try to tie the topic that we're discussing in the podcast to cognition. So what would you say is the influence of cognition, and what does cognition mean in the work you do?
Okay, I work on philosophy of mind and emotion, where cognition just sort of plays a major role, or in which cognition plays a major role. And one thing I try to do or have done in the past 2 years is try to sort of combine trans philosophy with philosophy of mind and philosophy of emotion and try to look at these intersections. So try to look at how can trans perspectives inform philosophy of mind? Why is that useful, not just for trans people or trans philosophers, but for everyone doing philosophy of mind? So try to understand sort of the norms that trans people are subjected to, but also say that these are not just norms that trans people are subjected to, but everyone is subjected to, meaning also subjected to in terms of how their minds work, because they, for example, manifest in how we are supposed to express emotion, or also manifest in how we are able to recognize emotion. So I've tried to bring these together, and there have been other trans philosophers doing that. For example, trans philosophers looking at phenomenology, looking at what is transness like, this question, looking at what kinds of cognitions are involved in experiencing our own gender. So I think there's a lot of overlap. It has just been overlooked before trans philosophy has come and entered the picture.
Okay, and as the last closing thing, so if people have listened to this podcast and they were to take away only one or two things, what would you say would be the best thing to take away from this podcast?
Oh God, I don't know. I feel like people should decide for themselves.
Or what would be a good takeaway, maybe? Maybe it doesn't need to be the best, but like a good takeaway.
That's really hard to say. I don't know. Listen to trans people, I guess. I don't know.
Nice. Yeah.
That's short enough.
Then thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It was really nice talking to you.
Yeah, same.
As you might have noticed, this time we didn't have as much time to go in depth into the topic, just because there was no other possibility to make time for this recording, but we still really wanted to talk to Jen. So in case you noticed that there are words, for example, that Jen used, like phenomenology, that have not been explained anymore at the end, we will try to provide links and resources to all of the ones we have noticed in the show notes. So in case you have any questions, go and check them out or write us an email.
You've listened to Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced by Clara Kühne, Imogen Hüsing, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne. Produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through Conversations on Cognitive Science. This podcast is not sponsored and does not give us any financial profit. If you wish to support us, the most effective way is to do so by leaving us an up to 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and following us on Instagram. You can reach out to us via mail, comment on YouTube, or message us on Instagram. We are always happy to hear your feedback. Thank you again for listening to us and for your interest in science. If you have any questions regarding this episode or any of our other episodes, feel free to reach out. You can reach out to us via Instagram by sending us a direct message at kaleidoscience_pod or write us an email at kaleidopod@us.de. You can find both links to our Instagram and also the email address in our show notes. We do read all your comments and will also reply to you as soon as we can.